Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 24th of March. All things political this Monday at 9, which is what we always do on Mondays at 9. We have a lot to talk about, although the primaries, the latest round, are still some time ahead. We have news the last week. Certainly the talk about Senator Obama's speech on race has been continuing and evidently continued in churches all over the country on Easter Sunday. We'll look at Florida and Michigan and ask if redos in both those states are really out of the question now. Governor Bill Richardson endorses Barack Obama. Senator Hillary Clinton's numbers have been going up in the polls. What do we account for that? And we will look at Senator John McCain's trip to Iraq and look at how he fares in a general election. Sad news that the overall U.S. death toll in Iraq has now reached 4,000, and we'll talk about how that war plays in this campaign now and is likely to in November. Plus, we'll welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Our guest comes to us from the University of Maine at Framingham. Professor James Melcher is assistant professor of political science, and as a student, says many of his favorite professors, those he learned the most from in political science and other fields, were those who brought humor to their teaching. He was an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin, and he says that his motto is fun with a purpose. He teaches Congress and the presidency class. He teaches constitutional law, where he routinely sets up mock trial formats to help students explore real-life constitutional issues and also to see the issue from both sides. He is an advisor for the University of Maine Political Science Club. He is involved with a Portland-based nonpartisan nonprofit organization that's established to encourage and empower young people to affect positive community change through the political process. He says he caught the political bug as a six-year-old boy in Madison. He became keenly aware of the Nixon-Humphrey presidential election in 68, and by the age of 13 was handing out Jimmy Carter for President literature outside the University of Wisconsin. I also understand we won't put him on the spot, but we may ask him sometime this hour. He's evidently a talented impersonator and often makes part of his lectures dead-on impressions of famous people, politicians, news broadcasters, pop icons, and others. So much to talk about on All Things Political. Hello, Professor Melcher.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Well, it's a beautiful sunny day here in Maine. Life is good, and the Badgers are still alive in the basketball tournament, so overall isn't too bad.
And you're not in Milwaukee, where we had 15 inches of snow last week.
No, well, we've had our share of snow out here, too. It's proven to be maybe not the best year to have bought a house with a long driveway.
Right.
Have to be excavating ourselves, but I was just in Milwaukee last month and Madison visiting my family, and so I saw how the snow drifts are up over my shoulders.
Parents
still there in Westmoreland in Madison.
Oh, are they really?
Oh yeah, same house since 1951. My parents got married in Milwaukee in 1945 after my father got out of the hospital from the Second World War. They were college sweethearts at the old Milwaukee State Teachers College. My mom first met him on the Wisconsin Avenue streetcar all those years ago. So maybe I've learned some of my persuasion ability from my parents, that they persuaded each other to remain together 63 years, on Labor Day.
God bless them. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, you have really strong Wisconsin ties.
Oh yeah. I've got much of the state represented. My niece lives in Superior. My brother Peter just had their first baby down in Franklin. My sister teaches in Lancaster, Wisconsin, southwestern part of the state, and had when I was in graduate school, taught for a semester at River Falls and a semester at Eau Claire. So other than central, and we used to have a cabin in St. Germain. So other than central Wisconsin, I've got pretty much the whole state represented.
That's wonderful. And you caught the political bug. Much has been said about young people catching a political bug this year. I read that you caught the bug when you were 6 years old. Is this year unique? Have a lot of young people caught the political bug this year, do you think, Professor Melcher?
Oh, I was even five. I was five.
Oh, you were five.
Born
sorry.
In 1963 and clean it. Well, I mean, I think it's different for different people. In my case, It was Kleenex had a set of campaign buttons that you could order, you know, reproductions of Woodrow Wilson and Wendell Willkie and so on. And Cheerios had pictures on the backs of their cereal boxes of presidents that year. And growing up in Madison, politics is kind of in the air. And for me, I think my experiences were unusual, but this year there clearly seems to be a real involvement of young people that hasn't been seen in politics so much, that a lot's been said in political science and other literature about how the so-called millennial generation or Generation Y or, you know, the generation without a name or whatever you want to call them, has long been very interested in a lot of other sorts of civic engagement. They've always been interested in volunteering or involving themselves in causes or church or other sorts of things, and the big gap had been in politics, that there had been something that, well, oh, that's just old stuff, that's things I can't be interested in, you know, that's sort of my parents' era game. And I think things started looking a little bit different in 2004. There was a large surge in voter turnout among young people, particularly high among young African-Americans more than any other group, saw a large rise. So I think we're seeing a continuation of a trend that we saw 4 years ago, but having such a vigorous campaign brings people out. It's not, you know, this is the first time since, what, 1952, that there looks like there's going to be a convention that may go more than one ballot. It's probably the most wide-open race since 1928. So there's all kinds of things to get excited about, and it's not just people on the left or people on the right. You know, I'm seeing all around the country real energy from young people of a lot of political descriptions.
It seems so strange to have a lull in the primaries, doesn't it, Professor Melcher? I was so used to watching them every week, and now we got to wait a while.
Yeah, it feels like the rain delays I used to remember at County Stadium when I was a kid. It does. I mean, and the Pennsylvania is so large. You know, I'm sure that's part of what brought Barack Obama to speak in Philadelphia and his more perfect union speech, people are calling it. The primary season has become so very front-loaded, Kathleen, that it's amazing just how much states were tripping over each other to try and get in early. It looked like, you know, in our school cafeteria at University of Maine at Farmington, we have a day where there's tacos, it's very popular, and clam strips are also popular. And, you know, you see people wanting to bud the line sometimes and kind of nudge up a little bit and make sure they get up there. And the primary season was that way. I mean, it's been pushed. All the states tried so hard to get so early because for years it seemed like only the leftovers were left. And, you know, there wasn't even so much as a cup of chili for W or other people to try and pick up later on. And so, you know, California was historically one of the last races, and for years they had nothing to say. And so now the irony is all these states like Michigan and Florida that tried to kind of cut to the head of the line, not to mention the other states that were able to do so through the process like Nevada did, it's amazing that it's the late races like Pennsylvania that look like they're going to be so important the way Ohio and Texas just were, that really helped keep Hillary alive. So it has more time to have to do these sorts of other discussions that, you know, there's sort of a pause to kind of stop and look and see where things are. So yeah, it's kind of like the music stopping and I'm looking for a chair to sit down in. It's kind of different.
Do you think there could be more than one ballot at the convention?
It's conceivable. I think there's going, well, not the Republican convention,
no.
Certainly. I think John McCain's got that pretty well in hand. I don't think that's likely. You know, so many of the delegates are committed, and it's mostly between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So it's not as though there's large numbers of uncommitted delegates out there to be had. Nor do you have a situation where you have, you know, like a six-way race. It's not going to look like a political convention of the 1920s. Plus, unlike the conventions of the 20s, or going back further, you know, the 1924 race went over 100 ballots for the Democrats. The Democrats only, and Republicans only require a simple majority. It used to be that the Democrats required two-thirds, and when you needed two-thirds of a party as fractured as the Democrats have been over the years, that was very difficult. So I think it's unlikely. I don't think it will happen, but I would say it's the best chance of it happening that we've seen in many decades. I really don't think it's going to come to that. I think there's going to be an awful lot of pressure on the superdelegates that are still uncommitted to try and come up with a winner ahead of time. Now, I think that's some of where Bill Richardson's comments came in, where he was talking about, well, if it looks like we've gotten down to the end of the season and Hillary doesn't have enough, well, maybe Hillary should step out then. And, you know, that got reported by some people as Richardson says Hillary should leave now. So I don't think it's probably going to happen, but it's got a better chance of happening than has been true in a long, long time. Conventions have become kind of dull.
Mm-hmm.
They've become very choreographed. You know, at exactly 8:32 p.m., Tammy Baldwin will go on and speak about X or speak
right,
about
right.
Y. And the media has lost a lot of attention. So I think the other thing that's going to happen, even if it doesn't go more than one ballot, is I think there's going to be a much greater focus by the mass media on the Democratic convention than we've seen in a long time. When I was a kid, the major networks covered the conventions gavel to gavel, and they may not do that anymore, which is why C-SPAN exists. But, you know, it's got a lot more suspense.
Mm-hmm.
Usually where there's been suspense at the conventions, it's been about platform stuff. You know, what are we going to say about this issue or that issue? Or are we going to keep an Equal Rights Amendment plank in? And this year it's really much more about who we're going to nominate. There really isn't a deep ideological division. That usually when you see that kind of tension at a convention, it's about, you know, say Reagan and Ford in 1976 at the Republican convention. Well, Ronald Reagan wants to move the Republican Party in a more clearly conservative direction than Gerald Ford does. There really isn't that kind of really strong ideological divide between the two major Democratic candidates.
What are they going to do, Professor Milcher, about Florida and Michigan?
Your guess is as good as mine. They've been trying to, you know, well, first off, to just sort of set the stage, as people in Wisconsin, I'm sure, remember, Democratic National Committee has tried to impose a variety of rules over the years on what delegates may be seated. And Wisconsin ran into that same trouble when the Democrats were trying to prevent Wisconsin from using open primaries to select delegates. And so Michigan and Florida, trying to move ahead and cut the line, did so knowing that the National Party might take away their delegates for that. And I don't know what's going to wind up happening. There's been a lot of attempt to try and hold some sort of vote by mail. The governments of both Michigan and Florida are understandably extremely hesitant to go through the expense of running an election again. You know, as Al Gore could tell you, sometimes elections in Florida have problems that are difficult to administer. And as a result of that, if anything's going to happen, it seems like it's going to have to come from the candidates themselves, and it seems the campaigns have not been able to work out a compromise.
Right.
So it's really hard to say what's going to happen. I can't imagine that there's going to be a lot of pressure to do something to seat them. You're looking at not only two of the largest states in the country in terms of electoral votes, but two states that are awfully competitive. And the last thing, especially Florida, I mean, I don't think anybody needs to be reminded how competitive Florida can be. And so I think they're going to have to work out some sort of compromise where some sort of seating will happen, or that could easily be an issue that could be used against the Democrats in those states in the fall campaign. And I don't think that's something the Democrats particularly
right.
want to see happen in Florida.
We'll go to phone calls here in just a moment. There was word that a lot of people in churches yesterday heard talk about race due to Senator Obama's speech last week. You know, in a time when we're into almost daily news cycles, this speech seems to have taken hold in many ways, which I think is a terrific thing. I think that we need to talk about the many issues surrounding race in the country. We are going to remember that speech, aren't we, for a long time?
I think so. One of the courses I teach at University of Maine at Farmington is American political thought, and a lot of in a country like the United States, where we don't have as much of a philosophical tradition as ancient Greece had, or even to some extent modern France has had, a lot of where the memorable statements about the purposes of American politics and what happens in American politics come out of speeches. Now, some people are almost tripping over themselves to say this is the next Gettysburg Address,
mm-hmm.
and I think you need time. I think you need time to look at this after a campaign. But I think it certainly has the potential to be very memorable along the lines. I think the closest analog would be John Kennedy's speech to the Houston Ministerial Association in 1960, where John Kennedy, in his case, was dogged by the issue of his religion as a Roman Catholic. And in some ways, Barack Obama was, in essence, forced to do some of the same sort of thing. And having the opportunity to do it without all the intervening races has meant that this has taken on a life of its own. I think it's very interesting the way he set things up. It was very much an explanation of where he comes from on things, why the particular, I mean, it was about his specific situation, but also about the much broader situation. And race is a really hard issue to bring
up
in a presidential campaign. It's the kind of thing people only really bring up in some ways when they have to, unless you're, you know, a protest candidate like a George Wallace was, or you're a candidate with a, you know, like Jesse Jackson was, that, you know, made that consciously a part of some of the things he was talking about, though even Jackson tried to reach across some of those lines, as did Al Sharpton. But, you know, I think it was also very notable how he talked about other sorts of resentments, class resentments, how whites that don't have a lot of money may feel put out, may feel that they haven't been discussed. I thought it was very sober. I saw Jon Stewart talking about it on The Daily Show, and he said that after making fun of it for 5 minutes, which is his job, he said, you know, this is really remarkable that you've got somebody talking to Americans like adults on this sort of thing. I think there's the possibility, though. There's two different questions with it. One is, how will this be looked at in the long run? And I think in the long run, I think it will go down as one of the most remarkable speeches in recent presidential history. There really haven't been a lot of really signature big speeches like that, because big speeches like this tend to come at a time of crisis. Gettysburg Address is at a clear time of crisis. The Ministerial Association speech, or any number of other speeches, you know, the speeches of Ronald Reagan during some of the times of crisis in American politics, usually come out of a crisis, and usually you don't have those in a presidential campaign. I don't know whether it makes all the issues go away for him in the short run, though. In the short run, he's got people wanting to talk about some of these sorts of things, question him, some people saying, well, he didn't really repudiate him as much as I wanted to. So ironically, I think it has the potential to be something that actually could be in some ways divisive, that I think the people who are his supporters will be reminded of how powerful his oratory is, which is part of the job of being president. The words do matter. And I think they'll be reminded of that. People who didn't like him on the right will say, well, look, he's really being revealed for just kind of dancing around these questions, and he's not really saying these things. So I think it has the potential to be something that actually kind of hardens his supporters in favor of him and hardens conservatives against him.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Professor James Melcher is our guest for All Things Political this Monday, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Maine at Framingham. And our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We want to let you know that Jeremy Scahill is going to be with us tomorrow. He has done all the groundbreaking work on Blackwater and is one fearless and terrific young journalist. He's going to be giving the first annual Frank Zeidler Memorial Lecture at 7:30 tomorrow at the Milwaukee Public Library Centennial Hall, which is free and open to the public, and he will be with us during the 9 o'clock hour tomorrow. I'm Kathleen Dunn. To your calls in a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to your phone calls now for Professor James Melcher at 800-486-8655, starting with Asher from Sheboygan. Hi, Asher.
Hi, John and Kathleen. This is Asher Heimerman from Sheboygan.
Hi.
Good morning.
I wanted to make a connection with John. And, John, you said you started in politics about 13?
No, at age 5, actually, he said.
Yeah, my name is Jim, by the way. But my dad's John, so there's a lot of Johns in my family. But, yes, I started at 5, and then my first actual experience working in a campaign was when I was 13. I handed out leaflets that were at Badger football games and volunteered on Jimmy Carter's campaign.
Well, I just wanted to let you know that my first time volunteering for a presidential candidate was this past year for Senator Obama.
Ah.
And just to let you know, I am 14, but I got started in politics about age 13.
Wonderful. Good for you.
I wanted to comment about Senator Obama's speech this past week on race.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very moving speech for me because as a Senator Obama supporter and volunteer, he made a speech that really got me motivated and got me thinking because we don't see too much about either President Bush or Senator Clinton talk about this race issue other than this comment made by the Reverend about... I forgot what it was, but I think it was something about Hillary was never called an inappropriate word. And the media still talks about that every day, which is kind of getting old. So I just want to ask you, what do you think recently about the media saying that Clinton is playing the race card?
That's an interesting question. I think in a lot of ways she's stayed out of a lot of the discussion. You know, she gave an immediately favorable comment about the speech right after it was made. I would say where the race issue is being played much more is among conservatives and particularly on talk radio, that
mm-hmm.
a lot of conservatives on talk radio have been very critical. Some have said, you know, he really needs to disavow the comments. And there was a range of comments by Reverend Wright. One was about how Hillary's never been called the N-word. I think the goddamn America comment was one of the things that really elicited a lot of these sorts of things. And I think one thing that's been healthy about how Obama approached this wasn't just to talk about his former pastor, but to talk about this and connect it to a much broader issue. And I think what he really shined a light on, and I think he did a good job of this, is just how different perceptions are in different communities, that different groups of people often aren't really aware of what's going on in different racial communities or different religious traditions or a wide range of things. So I think in a lot of ways it was a real public service, but I think Hillary's been much more likely to criticize Barack Obama on other kinds of things. She hasn't played this as much. You know, they stepped away very quickly from the comments that Geraldine Ferraro made, so... I would say that's been much more something used against him on the right rather than on the left, and not so much by McCain himself, who really has avoided that issue. But certainly it's something that you really haven't seen much. The last time you saw this much of discussion of race in American politics was President Bill Clinton. You know, made a major effort at one point to say, I'm going to launch a year of national dialogue on race.
Mm-hmm.
And that was right before everything blew up in Washington with the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and that never really quite played out. But I think it's difficult, and I think he did a good job with a difficult topic.
Asher, thanks.
Congratulations to you for getting involved. That's wonderful.
Really, that's wonderful at such a young age. Good
Absolutely.
For you. Good for you. 800-486-8655. Jim from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to comment on McCain and cite a treasure trove of resources for people on McCain from the March 17th New Yorker, which is entitled Senator Hothead, the McCain Quiz. And it illustrates a couple key themes. One is that he is a hothead, and secondly, that he's not a straight talker. For example, in there they cite Pat Buchanan and Senator Thad Cochran, respectively, saying about McCain, he will make Cheney look like Gandhi, and the thought of his being president sends a cold chill down my spine. Also, on last year, McCain was quoted as saying that he voted to support the war and that he knew it was going to be long and hard and tough. And then, but before the war, he told Larry King that the success will be fairly easy. He told Wolf Blitzer that we could have an overwhelming victory in a short period of time, and that the Iraqi people would be grateful for those responsible for securing their freedom. So again, you know, just straight up distortions. And finally, on the some of the racial issues, he spoke at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University 6 years after having called Falwell and Pat Robertson agents of intolerance. He was punked by George Bush on the black child issue in South Carolina when he was running against Bush. But he was quoted on Bush saying saying, "I support him, I'm grateful to him, and I'm proud of him." And finally, he claimed that the Confederate flag flying over South Carolina Capitol was symbolized heritage, although previously he had been on record as having called it a symbol of racism and slavery. So this guy is not a straight shooter, and not only that, but he's really dangerous in terms of his attitude towards aggression and war.
Professor Melcher.
Well, there's a lot there to chew on. He certainly has a lot of there are a lot of people that have found Senator McCain very personally polarizing, and I think you saw that in a lot of the reaction of people in his own party, more than the general public. I think the perception of him as being short-triggered, hair-tempered, you know, very much prone to anger, is something that I think is seen more by insiders than by the mass public. I think the mass public tends to see him as above the fray. I'm about clean government. I'm going off and look at my experience. But there are a lot of conservatives that have had a lot of personal problems with him. Rush Limbaugh was extremely critical of him. Ann Coulter talked. I think the Ann Coulter quote, you know, the very sharp, acid-tongued, suggesting liberals are traitors, conservative commentator said, "I'd vote for the devil before I'd vote for John McCain, and that's why I'm voting for Hillary." And so he does have that. But one thing I think is a legitimate question to ask about John McCain is someone who's been this much of an outsider, this someone, whether or not he's backed up everything he's said, carries himself and wants people to see him as somebody who speaks truth to power, that is blunt, is bold. How well will somebody like that work with members of Congress? You know, part of the job of being president is smoothing things over, working well. A lot of why Jimmy Carter had difficulties as president was his inability to kind of play some of the games with members of Congress. So regardless of how you look at the side he's taken on a lot of these questions, one of the things that I really think he's going to have to answer is he going to be able to build relationships with some of these people that he's had a lot of difficulty with over the years as president?
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, I don't know if you pay any attention to these things or think they're at all meaningful, but certainly McCain's numbers, if you put him against Clinton or Obama, it's a pretty strong match here. He's doing pretty well, and his numbers have gone up. How do you explain that?
Well, I think he's, you know, it's a different thing to run for the nomination of a party than it is to run for president in a general election. That a lot of his weakness was conservatives saying he's not a real conservative. Look how he supported McCain-Feingold. Look how he didn't support all of President Bush's tax cuts. He's not a pure enough conservative. And within a nomination process, that's a major problem that you managed to overcome. But on the other hand, that doesn't become such a problem in a general election. He's long been relatively popular with people. You know, a lot of Democrats liked him. I remember students changing their party registration in 2000 so they could go vote for John McCain. We have party registration in Maine, unlike Wisconsin. And so he's had this image,
sure,
you know, whether deserved or undeserved, that he is this sort of blunt person. Plus, the Democrats have been attacking each other the last few
mm-hmm.
weeks. And he's going, "I'm going abroad, I'm looking presidential." And part of what he's doing there that I think has helped him surge in the polls is whether you like what he does in foreign policy, whether you like, I mean, certainly was the strongest candidate in terms of defending President Bush's actions in Iraq. Whether you like that or not, he certainly has been visible doing foreign policy things over the last week. And that's going to be one of his major themes. He's going to say, you know, what has Barack Obama done or Hillary Clinton done in this stuff? Well, I've been involved in these things for years. I know the military, and we need somebody that's going to follow this. It's not unlike what Rudy Giuliani was talking about when he was running for president.
Mm-hmm. He's going abroad, but he's making some incredible statements about Iran and al-Qaeda, isn't he? Do you think that's intentional, or why does he have to be reminded of what's going on there?
Yeah,
it seems weird.
I guess it was Joe Lieberman which
right.
is a whole interesting story in itself, that whispered in his ear that, no, it's not al-Qaeda in Iran. And I don't know. I can't imagine that would be intentional. The mass
right.
media play on gaffes horribly, and they take on a life of their own. Mm. though I think it's long enough before the general election that probably isn't going to hurt him. On the other hand, I think what Democrats are certainly going to pick on is, see, this is part of a pattern he has of being overly belligerent to Iran. The infamous example where he was singing bomb, 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 bomb,
right.
Iran, and you know, there's a lot of people go, wow, this is a trigger happy cowboy here. I'm not sure I like that. So I think his problem is if he comes along and says that on other occasions, people are going to say, well, I thought Mr. Foreign Policy was a little smarter about these things. How come he's saying it? I can't imagine that was part of a conscious strategy. Sometimes we get an idea in our heads and we just kind of run with it. Maybe that's it. But I can't imagine you'd bring, something like that on yourself. The other thing could be maybe he's getting bad intelligence. You know, there could be, some intelligence he's got access as a senator to things I don't have, and maybe somebody's given him information that's not plausible, like the yellow cake things that came
out. You got to watch out for bad intelligence these days.
Yeah. Yes, and some of my students sometimes think my intelligence is too good when I'm grading midterms.
Thanks, Jim, very much for the call. Let's go to Betty from Glendale. Hi, Betty.
Good morning. Does anyone know who is responsible for releasing the selective clips of Reverend Wright's sermons that has affected Hillary's gains? If it came from the Republican Party, somebody there in their camp, wouldn't that be advantageous to the Republicans as well as Hillary?
I certainly think the way things have played out certainly have been advantageous to Republicans, and they've inflamed. Part of what it's done is it's helped galvanize conservatives behind John McCain. You know, not only do we have to fight Hillary, we have to fight this person that's dangerously divisive. I mean, it's difficult to overemphasize how much fence mending John McCain has to do with the right wing of his party. But there's an old saying, I think, from the Middle East that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And between the New York Times stories that conservatives thought were a shot against McCain to these recent things, I think you're seeing a lot of conservatives being distracted from the things they didn't like about McCain. Oh, yeah, he's the best hope we have to stop Hillary Clinton was a lot of what motivated them, and now maybe to Obama as well. As far as who posted them, given the way YouTube works and
right.
a lot of the rest of that media, it could be almost anybody. And, we'll never be able to track this for sure. And certainly, shenanigans aren't a thing of the past. If we look at the headlines out of New York this week, I thought were very interesting, that the original tip to the FBI about Governor Spitzer's prostitution liaisons came from one of his Republican political opponents that wanted to embarrass him, and Governor Spitzer himself had tried to take actions earlier when he was governor to expose others. So it could be almost anybody. It's almost like playing a game of Clue, where you've got all kinds of suspects who could have their fingers on some of these things. But does it benefit conservatives? And I think it absolutely has. I don't think there's any question about that. But I think within the black community, I think that's rallied a lot of African-Americans to Obama's side. I thought Eugene Cain wrote a very perceptive column in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about this a week ago, about how they see that a lot of African-Americans are saying, well, you don't really understand our experience. You don't understand what's going on in here. But certainly I think it's something that I think it's been more beneficial in a lot of ways to galvanizing conservatives than it has been for galvanizing support for Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. It was bound to come out, though, Betty. Don't you think? He'd been pastor too long, and there are too many people who have tapes and cell phones and all of that. It was bound to come out at some point.
Mm-hmm, I think so. But yeah. I wonder why there haven't been any of his good sermons.
Well, I mean, and presumably the sermons are, from what I understand, very, very long sermons over many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of Obama's point, and I think it's a good one, is that you don't have to take isolated things as an example of everything they're about. You know, I'm the cantor of my choir at St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Augusta. I don't agree with everything any of my pastors have said over time. But I think it speaks to a broader point in American politics, that the things the media get excited about, especially now that we've got more blogs, more people posting on YouTube, is there's a lot of kind of unrestrained interest in the sensational. Let's put out what's really going to inflame people. And American politics for years, I think, has placed much too much importance upon gaffes, upon misstatements. Oh, look, Bob Dole fell down. He's clearly too old to be president. Or, you know, Gerald Ford about Poland in the debate. So I think it very much is the kind of thing where people, especially in an age of YouTube, can be incredibly selective, just like, you know, sometimes if you were talking, trying to convince somebody not to do something, like, you really shouldn't buy that house, Jim, you might not bring up the nine things that are good about it, you might bring up the one. So it's partly human nature, but I think it has much more to do with how decentralized a lot of media things have become and how the sensational... I think the leading bias of the American media is toward the sensational, you know, is this exciting? Is this different? And you could probably put together hours of any preacher preaching where they would be saying things that wouldn't be divisive, but then talk radio and media wouldn't be talking about it. But I think in all of our lives, we have to be, I think that's something to be careful of on who knows, maybe somebody years from now might be tape recording this show and use it in some way to say, you know, Jim Melcher claims he loves America, but does he really love America? That doesn't surprise me that you could kind of sift for, kind of like panning for gold. You're kind of sifting for some things, but it's also part of a focus on candidate-centered campaigns. We talk about a lot in political science that, you know, we know more sometimes about what vegetables. You know, very famously, President Bush Sr. didn't like his broccoli, didn't like those sorts of things, lacked pork rind. And, you know, I'd be really more interested in, what are you going to do with tax policy? What are you going to do with trade? What are you going to do about foreign policy? No, we need to know if he eats his vegetables. And it's all sort of part of this kind of excessive focus in some ways on personality. And I don't think that's a left or right thing. I think that it's part of a broader celebrity culture, you know, a culture that, you know, gives Britney Spears so much attention, sure, or whatever star has been arrested. And I think that's part of what has made people cynical about politics and part of why how galvanized young people are today is so remarkable.
Professor James Melcher, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Maine at Farmingham, is our guest. And this is All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All Things Political this hour, the second hour of our program today. Our guest says human evolution has been gathering speed for the past 50,000 years. Natural selection may be changing the human genome faster than ever. That's coming up after 10 today. All Things Political this hour. We always talk politics Monday at 9 o'clock. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm going to go back to Richardson for just a second before we return to the phone calls. Does a speech like that influence superdelegates at all? Does it give them the go-ahead to go for probably Obama in this case, or is it fairly meaningless, Professor Melcher?
Well, I mean, I think it's significant on some other levels. I think that could be an effort on Governor Richardson's part to be considered as a vice presidential candidate with Barack Obama. He has a lot of the things that Obama lacks in terms of foreign policy experience and administrative experience. It may have some effect on superdelegates, though the Clinton campaign, I thought, parried that very effectively by saying, well, Hillary carried New Mexico, so you don't really have a right to say some of those sorts of things. I think it also has the potential. Governor Richardson did very, very well among his fellow Latinos, and I think it has a potentially strong impact along those lines. But Hillary Clinton has done much better at among the Latino vote than Barack Obama has, and so that may open some of those sorts of doors, but I don't know that it's going to necessarily switch. I think the people who are superdelegates tend to be, you know, really sort of professional politicians. We're talking governors, state party chairs, those sorts of people. And, you know, it certainly can't hurt. And I think in some ways the Clinton people overreacted. In particular, James Carville's comments.
Right, those were obnoxious.
Really quite extraordinary to compare him. He made a reference to Good Friday, saying, well, we're very close to Good Friday, and, you know, this reminds me of Judas taking the 30 pieces of silver. And that, to me, that was long out of bounds. But, you know, one of the criticisms people have had that this exposes of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, as some people argue, they have this sense of the people who are loyal to them
right.
and the people who aren't, and the twain shall never meet. And that's one of the things that President Bush has been criticized for as well, that he kind of, you know, you're either with us or you're against us. And some people see Hillary as being that way. And the reactions of somebody like a James Carville, I think, are very harmful to Hillary on that regard.
Yeah, and Richardson's comments were pretty strong, that they have a sense of entitlement, the Clintons. He went on with his talk over the weekend, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And that's a comment that you hear a lot from conservative critics of Hillary Clinton. It's unusual to hear that
right.
said within the Democratic Party, but for somebody who's always considered himself a friend of the Clintons,
mm-hmm.
remember, he was a major player in the Clinton administration. He was Secretary of Energy. He was Ambassador to the United Nations. So this isn't somebody that you would expect to say those sorts of things about and has some inside knowledge. Certainly burned some bridges with the Clintons.
I would say so.
And then he's backpedaling the next day. Well, no, I really still think the Clintons are my friends, and so on.
I don't think at the moment they're real friendly.
it's hard to put that toothpaste
yeah.
back in the tube
right,
once
right.
it's come out. Yeah?
Elaine from Madison, hi.
Hi, I want to go back to some of the comments about Obama's speech about race. And I guess my question is, in light of the you know, how it's sort of pushed it into a national conversation, I want to know, at what point does race, a conversation about race, really become a conversation about racism, which is what I think we need to, it's not about pointing out, you know, who's what color. It's not a coloring book. This person's white, this person's black. It's about the power structures that have made race an issue. And at what point does that, how do we make that the focus of this conversation?
Well, I think that's part of what he was trying to do in explaining why corrective action is necessary now. He said, look, there has been, in trying to explain Reverend Wright's inflammatory statements, he said, look, you have to understand that this man grew up in an era of overt racism, grew up in an era of exclusion that led to a high degree of bitterness. And I think that the way he brought it in was the way to do it. That I think race has often been a case where people, when they say they want a conversation on both sides of the question, really mean we need to talk. And, you know, there's an old saying, when we need to talk, it means I need to talk and you need to listen. And I think the only way you're really going to get a dialogue is the kind of way Obama did in talking about, all right, there's been a history of this organized racism, you need to understand this, but other people need to understand where the resistance is coming from. That I thought the way he did that was very artful in talking about how there are multiple grievances on these sorts of things, because when it becomes a I need to tell you without balancing those things, it makes people defensive, makes people not want to talk about those sorts of things. And I think to have a national dialogue on race, it has to look like something where everybody's invited, as opposed to something you're going to sit in a lecture hall and have to listen to. So I think if it's going to happen, it's going to be along the lines that he did.
Right. I think that goes along with the how you were saying earlier. He brought up class is also is very, you know, class and race are inextricably linked, and in how he brought up the fact that poor whites have also, they have, I mean, if you look into sort of critical race theory and the formation of race, it was, you know, a lot of why blacks became, you know, it has to do with class and sort of distribution of wealth, and he sort of pointed out it's really who has formed a lot of these problems is a sort of a corporate class that's been sort of disempowered a lot of people from below, and blacks and whites included, and we need to sit back.
Right, and that's exactly where he's trying to steer things, you know, that it's not, you know, this race's fault that these jobs are being moved abroad or these sorts of things. But you're right, of course those things are very inextricably linked. But one of the issues the Democratic Party has had since the 1960s is this question: how do we fight inequality, how do we fight racism in a way that doesn't leave the white working class feeling left out of things? And the white working class has been moving away from the Democratic Party out of a perception that you're taking care of them and you're not taking care of us. I mean, it's remarkable how much social income and socioeconomic status don't correlate with voting the way they once did when the Democratic Party was a more explicitly, you know, oriented, as Franklin Roosevelt put it, toward the man at the bottom of the economic pyramid. They've become more what Bill Clinton's talked about as the party of the forgotten middle class, and not talked about the working class or other sorts of folks. So it's a difficult balancing act for a Democrat, and I think he's done a good job in talking about that.
Thanks, Elaine. Frank from Madison, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
Very interesting. May I ask two related questions? To what degree would the guest accept that so far that the primaries have been largely sort of an artificial event? You know, we've had these contests, but basically the candidates are not addressing major issues substantively. They haven't really dealt with what's going on with the wars. There's two of them, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. And they haven't dealt with the performance of the economy and the current crisis, which could really be a major headache of the same size as the wars for any future administration. And
the second is,
aren't we in danger, because of the extraordinary character of the Democratic candidates, of ending up with a mess dealing with issues of gender and race in very inflammatory rather than substantive fashion? And a positive thing, haven't people, when they're voting, confounded the scripts assigned to them? So thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
A lot to chew on there also. I feel like I'm at the cafeteria back in Memorial Union. Well, part of why I think there, first off, I think you're absolutely right about the economy, that it's remarkable how, when you consider how important the economy is, how we've had this catastrophe in the mortgage markets and catastrophes on Wall Street and the collapse of Bear Stearns, how little we're really hearing that's innovative from any of the candidates, that it's really kind of, you know, play tape 4A, that we Democrats always raise this when times are bad and Republicans raise taxes raise taxes as an issue, let me say. And that it really hasn't been. I think there really hasn't been as much substantive discussion of the economy as much as, well, you were for NAFTA more than I was. And I think that ties into part of why there looks like there hasn't been that much issue discussion, because it's remarkable how contested a race you have between two candidates whose ideology as presented in the campaign is so similar that it's not as though they don't have position papers or points of view or haven't talked about things, but I don't think there's much for the media to sink their teeth into. You don't have this candidate's on this side of abortion versus the other one, or this one has a clearly different view on Iraq. And so I think what's happened is, because they're almost too similar in terms of what they're saying, that it becomes this huge fight over who said what when. And it reminds me of children pointing fingers at each other when a vase is broken and said, the other one did this first. And I'd rather have a discussion about where we're going to go more than who did what when on a number of these things. Now, elections are always somewhat artificial. I mean, I think that's one thing that's good about the current nominating process, that you have to go to a place like Iowa or New Hampshire and talk to people. I think a national primary would be a disaster if it was conducted on television, on this whole sort of wholesale campaign. As far as your second point about whether the election could descend into some of those things, well, it's a double-edged sword. You know, obviously, the idea of Barack Obama as a person, his history makes him able to speak about racial healing, is certainly something that has attracted people to him. The fact that Hillary Clinton is the strongest candidate as a woman for president ever has been very attractive to people. On the other hand, it could descend into some of these other sorts of things. I don't think it's going to. I think that the economy is going to push itself into consciousness. And when the general election comes, John McCain has a very, very different view on the war in Iraq.
Oh, yes.
Than either of the Democrats do. His famous statement, we're going to be there for 100 years. You know, and if you look at the model of, you know, American troops are probably going to be in Korea and Germany for 100 years. So I think that's I can understand where he's coming up with on that. But I think when you see, I think part of what happens is you start getting into personalities and who said what when there isn't enough other things for people to chew on. And I think in a general election, there's going to be no shortage of those sorts of things to chew on.
Professor Melcher, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
You're very welcome.
Professor James Melcher is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Maine at Farmingham, our guest on All Things Political, which you hear every Monday at 9 o'clock. Also has very strong Wisconsin ties. His parents still living in Wisconsin, and he caught the political bug as a five-year-old, in Madison when he was aware of the Nixon-Humphrey presidential election of 1968. A reminder that thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Tretter for on-air production. A reminder that tomorrow Jeremy Scahill will be with us, who broke the Blackwater story and has a lot to say about private companies in Iraq and also the war. He's going to be giving the first annual Frank Zeidler Memorial Lecture at 7:30 tomorrow at the Milwaukee Public Library Centennial Hall, which is open to the public, and he will be with us tomorrow during the 9 o'clock segment of a program which you are invited to listen to. I'm Kathleen Dunn. News ahead from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Monday conversation. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.